Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I am your host, Massimo Pigliucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Galef. Julia, what are we going to talk about today?
Massimo, this episode is a sort of follow-up to the previous episode, 41. If you didn't catch that, it was an interview with Robert Zaretsky, who's a professor of history, and he was talking about his book, The Philosopher's Quarrel, which is about the friendship and then the falling out of Rousseau and Hume. And a lot of the book is exploring the ways in which Rousseau and Hume both took issue with the central project of the Enlightenment, which was about glorifying progress and about trusting reason to solve all problems. And Rousseau and Hume each had their own issues with the idea of reason being the be-all and end-all. They objected to it in their own separate ways. So for this episode, 42, we wanted to talk about the limits of reason. And so we mean that not just in terms of the limits of human ability to reason, like ways in which our brains are not equipped to reason properly, but also the limits of fields that rely on reason, like logic and math and science, and the failures of attempts to justify those fields sort of from first principles.
And of course, we should note that since this is episode number 42, listeners will get the answer to the question of life, the universe, and everything by the end of this episode, right? No, wait, that was different.
To the degree to which it is possible to get, they will get it from our episode.
Oh, okay, yes. All right. Right, so the reason we think that this is an important topic, of course, for the skeptic movement, for science, for critical thinking in general, is because the entire movement of skepticism, the entire idea of science is, in fact, to use reason to solve human problems, to find out things about the world, how the world works, but also in the famous phrase of Francis Bacon, one of the early philosophers of science, one of the founders, actually, of essentially modern science, knowledge is power. And his idea was that by using reason, human beings will be able, first of all, to find out things about nature and then eventually to control nature. And, of course, that gets into the relationship between science and technology and improvement in our lives and so on and so forth. Very much the kind of things that Rousseau was highly skeptical of. He thought that modern life wasn't that much of an improvement to begin with, or at least that it was coming with too much trade-off with other issues, with other more fundamental issues about human nature. And Hume, on the other hand, had a very different kind of critique of the limits of reason, more from within the point of view of a skeptic. That is, he was pointing out that human reason is in fact limited intrinsically. There are certain things that we know don't work particularly well with human reason. In fact, it was in some sense a precursor of a lot of modern epistemology and a lot of modern cognitive science when it comes to the limit of reasons.
Yeah, so Rousseau wasn't actually saying reason doesn't do all the things. Reason can't solve all the problems or get all the answers that you think it can. He was just saying it doesn't make us better off to get
that's
those
right.
answers.
That's right.
Okay, so that's very different.
That's right. It's a different kind of critique. And I think that for this episode, we're going to actually mostly going to focus on the Hume side of the equation. That is, what
can't
is it?
Can't actually get all the answers.
Right. It can get us the answers, but what kind of answers and how does it work and how does it fail to work? I think it's actually probably appropriate to start with Hume as a bridge to the last episode, and in particular to the fact that Hume was, in fact, famously the one that showed that there is no ultimate foundation for reason itself, or at least for the kind of reasoning that is used in scientific investigations. So we talked about this briefly in earlier episodes. There are fundamentally two different kinds of way of reasoning, deductive reasoning and inductive reasoning. Deductive reasoning is what you do in logic and mathematics mostly. So you start with certain assumptions and you build a deductive argument, what's called a deductive argument, that leads to conclusions that are certain to the degree to which the assumptions are true. So if you start with true assumptions, the conclusion necessarily follow. This is the way mathematics works, and this is the way formal logic works. But that's not the way science works. I mean, scientists do help themselves to deduction, but largely most of science actually works by induction. Now, induction, it's a more sort of complicated beast. There is no one kind of induction. There's different types of induction. One of them, the classical version is simply generalization from a small sample of occurrences to a broader and broader sample of occurrences. So in fact, the whole idea of generalizing is a type of inductive reasoning.
And the puzzle is to figure out what are the legitimate generalizations to make.
Right. Now, there is a lot of discussion, of course, about, for instance, in statistics, as you know, about, you know, how much of a sample size do you need and how representative is the sample size? How do you make sure that the sample size is representative in order to do extrapolations, to generalize to the population, and so on and so forth. But that's not what bothered Hume. Hume was interested in a much more fundamental problem. He said, well, how do we justify induction itself? So why do we think that induction actually is a good idea and it's something that works? And however you put it, it turns out that the answer, it has to be something on the lines of, well, we think induction is a good idea because, or a good approach to find out things about the world, because in fact it has worked in the past. But Hume pointed out that that's circular reasoning, because now you're trying to justify induction on inductive grounds. Okay. Now, circular reasoning, it's a problem. If you don't want to defend a position by circular reasoning, because, of course, you're assuming the very truth of the thing you're trying to establish. This is known as the problem of induction, or as Hume's problem of induction. He posed it in the 18th century, and as far as I know, there hasn't been any reasonable answer to that problem. Plenty of people have tried, most famously Karl Popper, one of the most influential philosophers of science of the 20th century. The originator of the idea of falsificationism, the idea that a scientific hypothesis, in order to count as science, has to be falsifiable. There has to be a way to show that it is wrong if it is in fact wrong. If a statement is not falsifiable, then it's simply not scientific, because there is nothing you cannot even, in theory, in principle, prove that it's wrong.
So what was his answer to the problem of
induction? Well, he thought the falsification was the answer to the problem of induction because, since falsification is about demonstrating that something is wrong and not demonstrating that something is correct, Popper agreed that there is no way to prove that something, that a scientific theory is correct. Scientific theories can only survive one test after another, but you can never prove that they're correct. But you can prove, all it takes is one big stumble and, you know, one big fall, and you've proven that it is, in fact, wrong. Now,
I don't know. What if it stops being wrong tomorrow? I mean, that doesn't...
Well, the idea is that unless you're wrong about the reasons why it was wrong, right?
Right, but those reasons have held in the past, but it seems like Hume would say, well, how do you know they'll continue to hold in the future? That doesn't really seem to get at the heart of the problem to me.
No, it does, because the idea is that... let's say that a theory does make what is called a sort of naive or simple falsification, because then things get really complicated very quickly. But if the idea is that your theory, for instance, let's say Einstein's theory of general relativity, makes a prediction, and that prediction is that the light should be bent by gravitational forces by a certain degree and so on and so forth. You do the observation, it turns out the light is not bent by gravitational forces. Then, according to Popper, you don't really need to be bothered anymore by that theory, because you simply shown dramatically that a prediction of that theory turned out to be wrong. You can reconstruct that deductively, which is where we get to Hume's problem of induction. So Popper said, you know, if the theory predicts that this particular fact, the fact is incorrect, therefore the theory is wrong. That is, in fact, a valid form of deductive reasoning.
But there's no temporal component to that.
No, that's right.
So it doesn't yeah.
There's no temporal component to that. Well, yes, but it's hard to imagine. You know, it's easy to imagine how things can change in the future, in the sense that a theory that seemed to be confirmed all of a sudden start diverging from empirical data. It's hard to imagine a theory that actually has diverged from the empirical data then all of a sudden becomes reconciled with it.
But Hume's whole point was induction has always worked in the past, but what if that's not true tomorrow? That seems like at least as much of a fundamental, unimaginable situation, but it's still like, how do you say that? You know, how do you assign a probability to that continuing to hold or not?
That is correct. That is correct. That is why Popper reconstructed his falsificationism as a form of deductive reasoning. As I said, you know, you can actually put it formally. If theory X predicts fact Y, This is the reconstruction. If theory X is correct, then fact Y should occur. Fact Y should not does not occur, therefore theory X is incorrect. That is a deductively valid form of reasoning, meaning that if the premises are correct, the conclusion necessarily follows. Now, your objection is, well, but some of the premises might not be correct. It might not
I'm
be correct.
I'm just saying what Hume would say.
No. I don't think Hume would have a problem with that. I think you do have the correct objection, but I don't think that Hume would object on those grounds. Your objection is, well, but you just, one of the premises of the reasoning is that if fact Y turns out to be incorrect. Now, it may be that it appears to be incorrect today, but not tomorrow. That tomorrow we're going to find out that it was actually correct. That is not a problem for Popper, because Popper, by reconstructing the reasoning in deductive fashion, essentially agreed. That said, yes, if one of the premises turns out to be incorrect, of course the conclusion is wrong. But his achievement in theory, and the reason why he was so happy about it, was that he had managed to recast scientific progress in terms of falsificationism and then recast falsificationism itself as a form of deductive reasoning. If he had he succeeded in that, it would have been absolutely correct. That would have been a way to avoid the problem of induction, because there was no induction to be brought in. It was entirely science would have been established on a deductive basis. The fact is that doesn't work, and doesn't work because falsificationism doesn't work. And the reason falsificationism doesn't work is because even if you make a prediction and the prediction is wrong, there's plenty of history, plenty of cases in the history of science where the scientists are simply not abandoning the theory because the prediction is wrong, and that's for good reason, because there may be several different explanations for why the prediction turned out to be wrong. As you pointed out, for instance, the fact, or that is, the observation might be incorrect, right? So suppose that, and let's go back to my earlier example, suppose we're talking about the general theory of relativity, and that makes this prediction about light having to be bent by gravitational forces, and you try to observe and you don't observe it. You say, no, actually it's not. For Popper, that would count as a falsification of the theory. But somebody could reasonably object, well, maybe it's not the theory that was wrong. Maybe it was just that your instruments, your measurement instruments, were not powerful enough. Maybe there was a deviation and you certainly were not able to measure it. So there's always another possibility other than the theory being wrong that could account for the mismatch between the theory and the prediction. If that's the case, then the entirety of falsification falls down. It doesn't work, which means that we don't have an account in a non-inductive account of science. So science still does work by induction. If it does work by induction, and if Hume was correct that there is no rational way to justify induction, you know, the conclusion is kind of sobering. It's like, well, science works. It works because it uses induction, but we have no idea how to justify induction.
You know, it's never bothered me that much. I'm perfectly content to just have an asterisk on every empirical finding we ever have saying, you know, assuming induction continues to work. Like that, because the alternative is just so, it's such a sterile line of argument. I mean, you can't go anywhere.
Hume would have agreed. Hume did not.
This just seems like a disclaimer we just have to add to everything, and now we can just move on and ignore it.
But it should bother you. So here's the thing. From a practical perspective, Hume would agree with you. I mean, Hume was certainly not a radical skeptic. It was definitely not the kind of person that, and therefore we should stop doing science because, you know, we don't know what we're doing. Absolutely. He said, no, we will keep doing it because it seems to work and it does, you know, and does produce results. But we shouldn't be under the illusion that what we're doing is rational. Because when you try to answer the question, well, rational in what sense? What is the ultimate justification for what you're doing? You don't have a good answer for it. And a curious person, I think, should be bothered by that. We should say, wow, this is an interesting thing. Here's something that seems to be working. In fact, does work. It seems to me the ultimate application of reason. And in fact, it turns out we don't have a particularly good reason to believe that it should work.
That seems like an overly demanding way to define rational or reasonable, to demand that it have like an ultimate justification. I mean, you can always keep saying, well, why is this rational? Okay, well, why is it rational to be rational and so on? But that's, I mean, you could always just keep asking for more reasons.
No, not if you reach bottom. I mean, the idea was that if you were able to give a deductive explanation for why induction works, that's it. You would have reached bottom.
So you would actually have an answer.
I mean, I understand your point of an infinite regress, but this isn't the danger here. The danger isn't of an infinite regress. The idea is there could potentially have been a way to stop the line of questioning and say, okay, well, here it is. I'm giving you a deductive explanation for why induction works. Had that succeeded, which, as I said, was what Popper was trying to do, had that succeeded, that would have been it. Now, the thing that makes it, I think that makes it particularly interesting is that in the meantime, you know, meaning the early part of the 20th century, other people were trying to do the same with logic itself and with mathematics, right? So this was the famous quest that Bertrand Russell, for instance, was involved in.
Immortalized in logic comics.
Exactly. If anybody wants
look
to
look it up.
If anybody wants to look at the funny, interesting, well-drawn version of it, that's in logic comics.
Right. Logic comics, all one word with an X at the end. Okay,
correct.
Go on, please.
That is correct.
We'll add a link in the website.
Naturally. And so the quest that is explained in logic comics is was this. Bertrand Russell and several other famous prominent logicians in the early part of the 20th century were trying to establish a logical, complete, ultimate foundation for mathematics and ultimately for logic itself. And so the idea was similar, essentially, to the quest that had bothered philosophers since Hume's problem of induction, to establish the some kind of foundation for the way in which we proceed uncovering knowledge. Now, here's the problem. Just in the same way in which Hume had put the problem for science and Popper and many others had failed to solve it, it turns out that Russell and company also were not able to find ultimate foundations for logic and mathematics. His famous Principia Mathematica, which is a huge book, manages to prove that 1 plus 1 equals 2 after several hundred pages of workings. And it's nowhere near, according to Russell himself, anything that like what we would need in order to establish sure independent foundations for logic and mathematics. And what happened, of course, very soon was that Kurt Gödel came into play with his famous incompleteness theorems. And the incompleteness theorems by Gödel do show that, in fact, that quest simply cannot succeed, that you're not going to have a ultimate foundation for a logical mathematical system. Now, that leaves us in an interesting situation, it seems to me, because it leaves us at the middle part of the 20th century, where the two things that, or the three things, let's say, that we really seem to be at the foundation, at the basis of science and skepticism and so on, that is, the inductive method on the one hand, and mathematics and logic on the other hand, which means deduction, all of these things lack an ultimate foundation. We cannot justify why they work from a rational perspective. As I said, once I realized that this was the case, that kind of did bother me for quite a bit.
You know, I think one of the most interesting and important things that came out of the failure of the quest to justify math within itself was the understanding that math is not, it's not really true per se. It's sort of a useful system that we've established, but there's no, I mean, you pick axioms.
That's right.
That you then derive your mathematics, and I say your, not the mathematics.
That's
from.
Right.
But there's no reason that you would have to pick only those axioms. Like, you could just as easily, we have these axioms because they lead to math that accurately models the world that we happen to live in.
Or even that just have leads to math that has some interesting intrinsic property.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But you could add other axioms or take out other axioms and get a totally different
kind of math.
In fact, there are some axioms which are sort of indeterminately true or false. Like, you could choose to include them or not choose to include them, and you get different results either way. You've probably heard of the axiom of choice, which is just the axiom that you can pick. There's some method of picking an element out of any set, out of an infinite set of sets. Which seems like that should either be true or false, that there's a way of doing that. But it's not neither true or false. You can either say it's true and then you get a certain kind of math, or you can say it's false and you get another kind of math.
You get another one, right.
Yeah. So I think that, I mean, it is humbling in a way, at least if one were operating on the mindset that there is like some ultimate truth with a capital T.
That's right. And it is, I think it's humbling also in the sense that, again, the same exact reasoning, well, parallel reasoning works also for logic itself as well as for science. So for instance, in logic, it's the same idea. Logic, there's, first of all, there's more than one type of logic. In fact, there is essentially an infinite type of logics. And they work in the same way. You can start with certain rules or certain assumptions, certain axioms in logic and derive one type of logic. And you can start with different assumptions and different axioms. You can derive another kind of logic. Now, they're not arbitrary. One of the things that we should make clear is that you can't do these arbitrarily because a lot of these axioms, for instance, may lead to incoherence. They may lead to contradictions right. and things like that. So those are out. So it's not there is an infinite number of possibilities, but it's not. But there's also an infinite number of ways of doing it wrong. Right. So it's not like all of a sudden everything goes. In science, that has led, or I should say, in philosophy of science, because scientists tend to be very pragmatic and not particularly bothered by these things. But in philosophy of science, this kind of line of reasoning, that is, that the fact that as you put it a minute ago, the analogy with mathematics, that mathematics is not true in any big capital T sense of the term. It's just something that works in a particular way, and for particular purposes. In philosophy of science, that has led to the so-called anti-realist school of scientific theories. The anti-realist school essentially says that science is not about true models of the way the world really is, because we don't know and we cannot know the way the world really is. It's just about models that work well enough in terms that they give us predictions that we can act on, that we can, we make models, so scientific theories essentially are models of the world, and we don't know and we will never know whether they're true or not. We simply can know that some of these models work better than others and for practical purposes.
Quickly getting back to logic.
Yes.
Well, we talked about math not being true with capital T, but logic also, I've been astonished to learn, is also not taken to be true with the capital T. Like
That's
the
right.
fundamental principles of logic. Something as self-evident as, a statement can't be both true and false at the same time.
Right.
New York City Skeptics actually hosted a lecture a few months ago by a famous philosopher named Graham Priest,
he's a colleague of mine at the City University of New York. Yes,
right. And one of his big points is that we should accept the fact that statements can be both true and false, and that's the only way out of certain logical paradoxes.
That's right. He's a world expert in what is called paraconsistent logic.
Paraconsistent. Yes. Sounds suspicious. To me,
it does sound suspicious, but it's really intriguing for the reasons that you brought up. Now, all of this, however, I think has done something interesting at the in the middle part of the 20th century. All of these realizing that, science is based on induction, and induction, it's not justifiable rationally. Math and logic are based on deduction, and you run into the same kind of problem. You cannot have an ultimate justification of it. So in other words, this failure of foundational projects, what is the foundation of, what is the ultimate foundation of science, mathematics, and logic, has led philosophers in, broadly speaking, to a different way of looking at it. And perhaps the most important philosopher in that respect is Quine, who wrote a very famous influential paper in the 1950s called The Two Dogmas of Empiricism. And Quine's idea, which I think is broadly accepted at this point in philosophy of science, you can always find people disagree, but the idea is that, look, instead of thinking about a foundation for knowledge, we should think about a web of knowledge. Now, because the foundation metaphor implies, the edifice of knowledge or something, implies a foundation and implies the fact that there's a point where you start below which you don't go. You have a solid ground.
Something self-evident.
Exactly. Something is self-evident or self-justified or whatever it is. Well, now we know that that's not the case. So instead of looking at thinking of knowledge as an edifice that you keep building on and on and on, therefore for which you need some kind of foundation, think of it in terms of a web. Now, interestingly, by the way, many, many years after Quine wrote his paper, we entered the era of modern computing and database, and the largest database of scientific articles in the world is in fact called the Web of Science. Interestingly, they picked up that metaphor. Now, what was Quine's idea? Quine's idea was that, look, knowledge is actually more like a web where there is all these threads, some of which are very thick and very very large, and other ones are kind of tenuous and smaller. And some of these threads are connected to a bunch of other threads. Some of these threads, on the other hand, are connected to only a few things. And these threads represent both factual knowledge about the world as well as theoretical knowledge about the world. So part of the web is also the way we reason, all the scientific instruments that we use and the assumptions that go into building those instruments, as well as, ultimately, the rules of logic and mathematics itself. All of this makes for this web. And the idea was that when we find something that doesn't work, right, what we do is we find a thread that it's not working anymore. It could be a fact, it could be a hypothesis, it could be a theory, or it could be a larger chunk of things. We just cut it out and replace it with something else. But because we have a web, the rest of the web essentially keeps itself up without having an actual foundation, like a spider web.
Kind of this implicit hierarchy, though, that things at the center of the web are more fundamental, if not like the absolute foundation. And so if you were to cut those out, like something like, you know, belief in induction,
right,
then you lose a whole lot of other stuff.
That is correct.
Smaller, thinner threads at the periphery of the web can be more easily replaced.
That's right. Now, that is correct. And now Quine controversially went so far as saying that, you know, if it turns out that the laws of logic don't work and particularly well in a particular in a certain number of instances, too bad for the laws of logic. You should, you know, just cut them out and replace them with something else. Now, other people say, well, wait a minute. That may be the case, but before you cut that kind of thread, you better have really, really, you know, good reason for doing that. So you're right. Certainly not all the threads are created equal. Some of them are much more important than others. But I find a lot of appeal in this model because, first of all, it does away with the foundational metaphor. And second of all, it sort of gives you this idea of knowledge as a organic thing that keeps growing and that can be constantly replaced almost everywhere, if necessary. Of course, again, you have to have good reasons to replace some of the threads. But it's this open-ended quest where you're not going to bet your life on anything, including logic itself. You can say, well, you know what? Fine. If it turns out that the principle of non-contradiction is wrong, okay, fine. We'll do without the principle of non-contradiction.
That's the thing that Grand Priest is disputing, which seems self-evident to the rest of us.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm willing to go that far. At that point, when someone's telling me that something can be both true and false, my reaction is not, oh my God, that's amazing. It's, okay, how are you defining true and false? Because clearly we're not using the same definition.
Right. But as you know, people like Priest do have, start out with real problems, like, you know, the paraconsistent logic comes out of analysis of contradictory statements and paradoxes, right? So paradoxes are typically the thing that standard modal logic has a problem with, it cannot solve. Now, what you can do two things there. Again, you can say, well, we haven't figured out still how to solve the paradox, there must be a solution. Or after, you know, if a paradox has been around for a couple of millennia and nobody's figured out how to solve it, you might want to at least try Priest's and others' way and say, hey, perhaps we should revisit the foundations of logic and bite the bullet and say, well, it's not, the paradox is not a paradox, it's just an indication of the limitation of a particular kind of logic that we've been using so far.
I would at least be a little more comfortable with saying it's indeterminate. Like, neither true nor false, or it doesn't make sense to call this either true or false, as opposed to saying it's both true and false. That seems like a significantly
different... Yes, you're okay. Logically more conservative right. than
I guess I am. So why don't we move on now and talk about not the limits of certain fields like logic and math and science and philosophy, but the limits of human brains, because, you know, it is a sobering thought that our brains are not optimally designed to reason. And so if we, you know, in our quests to understand the world both inductively and deductively, we have a bit of a handicap.
Absolutely. So not only the first part of our discussion sort of showed that even reason under optimal conditions does have limits and does have, you know, in this again, Hume was right and other people were right. But as it turns out, human beings, who are the only examples of reasoning beings that we know of, don't work anywhere close to the ideal of a rational agent. I mean, we have all sorts of cognitive biases. We have all sorts of things that can go wrong, particularly the confirmation bias has been in the news quite a bit over the last several weeks or months. The psychologists and cognitive scientists that are finding out that confirmation bias is essentially a human universal. I mean, we whenever we have an idea, we tend to selectively remember or look for pieces of evidence that confirm that idea, and we discard or filter out pretty much anything that might potentially contradict that idea. Now, there are several suggestions on why that might be the case. For instance, there's this very influential article that came out recently in Behavioral and Brain Sciences in their volume 34 in 2011. The article is co-authored by Hugo Mercier and Dan Sperber, and it's entitled "Why Do Humans Reason? Arguments for an Argumentative Theory." Essentially, this is a evolutionary psychological take on human reasoning. And the idea that Mercer and Sperber put forth is that all these cognitive biases aren't example of things that go wrong with the human brain. This is the way the human brain is supposed to work. Now, that sounds like weird,
right? Go wrong in the sense of deviating from the processes that lead to the truth.
Right. But what their point is, which is interesting, is that they question the basic assumption that reason is to find out the truth about things. Okay.
No, you can't question that. That's the definition of reason.
Right. You would think. But they say, well, from an evolutionary perspective, it may actually turn out that reason is, in fact, an instrument to convince other people in your group to do things your way.
No, then what you should say is the human brain was designed as an instrument to convince people to do things your way. It was not designed to reason. You don't redefine reason as what the human... Anyway.
I would agree with you.
This is a semantic point, but I hate this kind of...
And besides, as you know, I tend to be fairly skeptical of evolutionary psychological explanations in general. We have done a show on that topic. Not because they're necessarily wrong. In fact, for all I know, Mercer and Sperber might be right. It's just that I think it's incredibly difficult to actually test these kind of hypotheses. But let's consider it for a minute. So what they're saying here is that human reason, let's make the distinction between ideal reason.
Human attempts to reason.
Yes, thank you. But humans' attempts to reason are flawed for a very interesting reason. That is, they're not truth conducive, they're not truth assertive, not because there's something wrong with the human brain, but because the evolutionary purpose, if you want, of reason is not to find out truth, it's to convince other people to do your bidding.
Right, so, in which case, the confirmation bias makes a lot of sense, right?
You're right.
Mustering arguments for your claim without bothering to check whether there are better arguments for another claim.
That's right. So according to Mercer and Sperber, instead of being evolved as philosophers and scientists, we evolved as lawyers. Right.
That's a nice analogy.
Right. Now, the problem with that argument in general. So, as I said, set aside how do we actually test this hypothesis? Because then we run into yet another discussion about the limits of evolutionary psychology. Mm-hmm. We already covered that.
Right.
But so let's even grant for the sake of argument that this is a reasonable hypothesis. It might be tested one way or another. The thing that bothered me when I read the article by Mercer and Sperber is that, okay, but wouldn't a marvelous way to convince other people of your point of view to make an argument that it's actually in agreement with the way the world actually is? I mean, after all, if I want to convince you that it is a bad idea to jump off a window of the fifth floor of a building in New York, it helps me, the fact that I have gravity on my side, right? It says, look, my friend, here, I can throw this stone and see what happens. It doesn't fly. So the argument becomes much more convincing when I can not only articulate the argument well, so I can use rhetorical skills, and that I would agree is certainly a socially useful skill, but when truth actually happens to be on my side. If I actually try to convince you to jump out of the window in spite of gravity, it seems to me that I might be able to come up with some rhetorical trick. But once you jump, I lost the argument.
Yeah, although those people aren't going to be around to, to dispute your authority.
That is true, but any witness might.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that is a dramatic example. But I guess if the benefit...
Well, I'm Italian. I go for drama.
So. Yes, you do. And you all listeners can't see his hands, but they're dramatic too.
Exactly.
I mean, if the benefit that natural selection confers on you for being rhetorically skilled is significantly greater than the benefit it confers on you in terms of like status and, you know, social, power for being right, then, you know, you're just selecting so heavily for the former that I could see the latter kind of falling by the wayside, even though it would help you if you were also right. It just wouldn't help you enough to, you know, have that trait be selected strongly for. Right. But anyway, I mean, I agree with your point.
Now, you would think, however, that even in that case, there would be also selection for essentially perfect reasoners, that is, you know, for other people,
just because they would be able to survive better, right?
Right. I would think that if in fact natural selection is favoring sort of rhetorical skills, then it would also automatically favor perfect reasoners that would be able to see through your logical fallacies and call your bluff. Yeah. Apparently, that has not been the case, however, because
I like the idea of our ape ancestors preferring to mate with the people who could decimate their opponent's logical arguments the most incisively. Yeah, that's the king of the harem.
That's right. There's some appeal to that.
I know you like that message.
Yes, for nerds, there is some appeal to that idea. Now, however, the fact remains that we do know that there are cognitive biases. There's no question. You know, however they came about, evolutionarily speaking, the fact is they're there, and they're very difficult to dislodge. So I read this article recently that sort of gets to that point from a point of view that actually is interesting for our usual discussions. The article was published recently, I think last year, in a philosophy journal called Zygon, and it's by Doran Recker. The title of the article is The Design Metaphor, How to Confuse Organisms with Mouse Traps. Machine metaphors and intelligent design. So it talks about intelligent design creationism, and you know the fact that creationists often invoke this analogy between, or even identity between, living organisms and machines, and say, look, if a living organism is a machine, machines are designed for a purpose, so we must have been designed for a purpose. That's the basic idea. Mm-hmm. Now the author here makes an interesting point. She says, look, this is not a mistake. In the sense of, you know, there's a bunch of stupid people who like to argue in a fallacious way. The metaphor, first of all, because human beings think by metaphors. We simply cannot avoid thinking and speaking by metaphors. There are several interesting examples in the paper, for instance, when we say things like, oh, I feel down today, right? Well, we don't normally mean that as a metaphor. We mean it literally, I feel down. But in fact, it is a metaphor. We're not down.
It's really so interesting when you really examine our speech, just how much of it is metaphorical.
Exactly.
I love doing that.
So on the one hand, the idea is, you know, there is no way not to think by metaphors, not to think by analogy. This is just the way human beings think. So one thing we should not fault, for instance, creationists, is for thinking metaphorically or by analogy. The other thing is, well, actually, as it turns out, that particular metaphor, thinking of a living organism as a machine, is very productive. It has been very productive. It was, for instance, at the basis of the origin of modern medicine. When Descartes famously equated the body, both the animal body and the human body, to a machine. Part of his point was, look, it's made of pieces and things that work together for a purpose, which means that if something goes wrong, it means you can understand what it does. You know, the heart is a pump. It serves the purpose of pumping blood. Mm-hmm. It also means that you can intervene and fix it, just like with any machine. So not only the metaphor is a natural way to think about it, it's also true that, in fact, it does deliver in a lot of other applications. Of course, it just happened to be the case that thinking about the evolution of, you know, the diversity of life on Earth in terms of intelligent design is the wrong way to think about it. But the author here, the article in Zygon, points out that is a fairly sophisticated achievement of modern science that was inconceivable before Darwin. You know, before Darwin, we didn't have an alternative mechanism. We did not have an alternative explanation. Mm-hmm. And it is true that very few people really are exposed to or understand the theory of evolution, and so that we shouldn't really go around, you know, being too cocky about thinking that 90% of humanity is stupid just because they don't get evolution. There is an interesting analogy that this author points out that I thought made a good point. The other the article has a couple of figures. One of them is illustrated the so-called Miller-Lear illusion. The Miller-Lear illusion is that situation. I'm sure most people have actually seen somewhere where you have two lines of equal length, but they look different of a different length because in one case some sort of arrow-like segments are coming out of outside toward the outside of the line, and in the second case they're going inside. The eye is fooled in the thinking that the two lines are a different length because of the position of these flaps, basically at the end of the lines. In reality, if you measure them, they are exactly the same distance. Now, the same length. Now. The Diagon article says, look, it's not that there is anything wrong with vision. You can't say, oh, vision doesn't work because it cannot tell that the two lines are the same. Vision works exactly the way it's supposed to work. It works most of the time. It's just that you happen to have bumped into a particular situation where the way in which the visual apparatus and the brain, the human brain is constructed, makes a mistake. But it isn't a mistake. And even if you correct that mistake, if you tell the person, look, those two things actually are of the same length, even if you measure the two segments and you realize, you know, measurement in hand, that they're the same length, you still cannot avoid seeing them as of a different length. That is, even once you know that there is a bias there, that mm-hmm. you're getting things wrong, the brain doesn't correct them. Doesn't correct the bias. It's still there. You still perceive it in the same way. So the basic idea is: look, let's go easy on these people who make mistakes because of cognitive biases. Because these are, in fact, first of all, not mistakes in the broader sense of the term. This is just the way the human brain works, and it does work most of the time. The so-called cognitive biases actually are heuristics that work most of the time. They allow us to make reasonable decisions quickly under a lot of circumstances. They fail in certain areas, and in those areas is where you need special training in, you know, logic, critical thinking, mathematics, probability theory, or science to figure out what's wrong. But because that training is very specialistic and it does take time, you know, it's just like the idea is let's go a little bit more easy on people and cut them some slack because they're not stupid. They're just using the brain the way they're supposed to be using it. They just don't have the additional training that it takes to be a scientist or a logician or whatever it is.
Before we wrap up, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the idea that our brains were not actually designed to reason properly, especially about really complex things that are far outside of the environment that, you know, our ancestors grew up in. I do think that it throws into doubt our ability to actually solve a lot of the questions that we're interested in the future. I mean, yes. Not to say that we won't, but it does. I mean, yeah. Even if we can actually collect all of the empirical evidence that we would need to answer all of our questions about the nature of the universe and time and space and consciousness, it seems entirely plausible to me that our brains just would not be equipped to. Even if we you know, through experimental results, got an answer about time having a distinct beginning, well, how can we hope to really comprehend what it would even mean for time to begin?
That's right.
Or about, you know, how could we hope to comprehend what it would mean for there to be a, you know, near infinite number of universes? So, you know, they're like, I'm somewhat optimistic in that over time, I individually and also we as a species have gotten better at understanding things that seemed just, you know, completely unintuitive or even contradictory.
Right.
But who knows whether we're actually going to be able to wrap our minds around some of the results that we're going to get in the future.
No, that's exactly right. And philosophers have a term for that. It's called epistemic limits. And they distinguish between two different kinds of epistemic limits. One is the kind of limit that is posed by accidents. That is, you know, for instance, we may never be able to figure out how life originated on Earth, not because it's an impossible problem, but because we might never find enough clues
to
the situation. Right. So that just happens to be the case.
Yeah. And I was saying, just even if we did have all the clues.
Right. Exactly.
I don't trust that our reason is going to be able to really feel like it understands
exactly.
the implications of those clues.
That is the second level of epistemic limit. That is, there might be limits that are intrinsic to the human ability to reason, to figure out things. But on top of that, throughout this at the beginning of this podcast, we also have discussed epistemic limits that might be intrinsic in the very idea of logic and science itself, regardless of the limitations of human beings. So,
right, that's an interesting way to put it. Like limitations inherent to the disciplines, like inherent to math, and then limitations inherent to our ability to understand those disciplines.
That's right. And then just limitations due to luck.
Right, exactly.
Some of the clues might have disappeared.
All right, on that fatalist note, we are out of time, so let's wrap up this section and move on to the rationally speaking picks.
Welcome back. Every episode, Julie and I pick a couple of our favorite books, movies, websites, or whatever tickles our rational fancy. Let's start, as usual, with Julia's pick.
Thanks, Massimo. My pick is a book. It's called Feeling Good, The New Mood Therapy by David Burns. And it's a very like readable, popular introduction to the field of cognitive behavioral therapy, which is, I think we've discussed on the show before, it's the one really solidly validated school of therapy, essentially.
Talk therapy, yes, that's right.
Yeah, of talk therapy, thank you. And David Burns is one of the founders and popularizers of it. It's been a bestseller since it was published, I think, for the first time in the 70s. And they've actually done studies where they've given this book to people who are depressed, and then they've had control groups of people who are depressed who didn't get this book or who had some other control. And the people who just were given the book and told to read it did significantly better in the long run for future checkups to see if their depression had improved. So, and the reason that I think it's appropriate to use this as a pick on our Rationality Skepticism podcast is that, so cognitive behavioral therapy, there are sort of two components intertwined, the cognitive one and the behavioral one. The behavioral one is really more just about training yourself and getting into certain habits and hacking your brain to some degree to get yourself to behave and react the way you want to behave and react. But the cognitive part is really much more about using rationality to make your life happier and more productive and, more effective and more efficient. So often what will happen, and I've seen this in my own life and the lives of friends, is that you'll have some negative emotional reaction to some situation, and you won't really examine what's at the root of the emotion. It feels like a very natural emotion to have, like, I don't know, meeting someone who's better at something that you care about than you are and feeling bad. And so you won't actually question the negative emotion, and you don't try to get rid of it because it feels like the natural emotion to have. But then when you really dig down, if you really dig down, you find that giving rise to that emotion are a whole bunch of actual false beliefs about the world or false reasoning about the world. And you can actually like cash those out in terms of logical fallacies and cognitive biases that lead to these beliefs. And so the book gives all these very concrete practical exercises for like taking your emotion and working backwards. So why do I feel this? Just, say the first claim that comes to your mind and then, okay, well, what evidence do I have for that? Or like what process of reasoning did I actually use to come to the belief that made me sad or angry or anxious or so on?
That's very interesting. I read a few years ago a book with similar premises, although in a completely different way. Starting out with which was exploring the relationship between Aristotle and cognitive behavioral therapy.
Oh, really?
The idea was essentially the same, that a lot of the stuff that causes us problems is actually the result of unquestioned assumptions. And then if you question those assumptions, you reconstruct your reasoning, your hidden reasoning, then you see that actually you don't need to be bothered by whatever it is that the problem happens to be. So it's that's interesting.
I mean, like meeting someone who's better at something than you are. Did you really think that you were the best in the world?
Right.
Like, clearly there exist people who are better than you.
I'm sorry, Massimo, we'll talk about this later. Yes, we'll talk about that later.
Anyway, what's your pick?
So my pick is an article that appeared recently in the Chronicle of Higher Education by Damon Horowitz. The peculiar thing about Damon Horowitz is that he holds an interesting job and a very unusual job. He's the philosopher in residence at Google.
I've never heard of that. It's so
right.
wonderful.
So Google has a philosopher in residence.
Oh, my God.
And this guy is actually a technologist. I mean, he started out with a degree in computer science, and he started up his own company, which was bought by Google. And then it turns out that he sort of went back to school, got a PhD in philosophy, and now he is, as it turns out, as I said, Google's in-house philosopher.
He must be the only philosopher who gets fed caviar with like shoulder rubs at lunch.
It may be, although I found out actually a couple of years ago that one of the major TV networks, I forgot which one, if it was NBC or ABC, also has an in-house
really?
Philosopher. So
wow.
Yeah, apparently it's a small niche, but there is one. The article is interesting. It's called From Technologist to Philosopher, Why You Should Quit Your Technology Job and Get a PhD in the Humanities. And it's all about the value, both in practical terms, interestingly, as well as in sort of a broader term, in terms of sort of, if you will, meaning of life kind of thing, that studying the humanities has. It's really interesting. It's well argued, of course. Again, as usual, one doesn't have to agree with everything there, but it is very, very good food for thought. And it's certainly from somebody who has tried both and has been successful at both approaches. He's both, as I said, a technologist and a philosopher. So he's done both sort of the science-y approach to things and the humanities approach to things. And he thinks that his life and career are much better precisely because he managed to do both. So it's an interesting
interview. We should have talked about it in the humanities episode.
The article wasn't out yet.
Of course, this is always new material to add into the discussion. Okay, well, that wraps up another episode of Rationally Speaking. So join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.